just went from Area 3 to Area 5, but the whole area setup was built to be people-rated. And I think within a couple of years, you're going to see the Area 6, that's the new one coming out, which will eventually replace 5. John? Physics.
Okay, Paul, thanks for that info. Back to you, Dick, KC2WQB.
I heard somebody say he had a physics question. We were getting some dropout. So who was that person? It sounded a little bit like Roy, KC2JAS. Person with a physics question, go right ahead. K2RIW, the tech man.
Yes, this is Roy. Roy.
Dropouts there, Roy. You were only in 10% of the time. I wonder if anybody was hearing Roy on the input. I was not. I'm up here on Long Island. Roy's in New Jersey. Was anybody hearing Roy on the input so we could hear his question? Or do you have any other way you can get to us, Roy, by way of Echolink, IRLP, different...
Yes, I heard his question.
Fire away, John.
Basically, he's asking, how do you measure temperature in a vacuum? If there's no molecular action, what is the temperature? We've covered this before on the net, but that's what I believe Roy is asking. Roy, I can hear you on the input if you answer. Is that correct or not? Okay, sorry, the name is Roger. All right, Dick, that is the question, and he said that's correct. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I think I was making that mistake of calling him Roy. Everything you put in space will come to some particular temperature, every piece of hardware you put in space. And the main thing that determines the temperature it will come to is literally how you paint it, what material you put on the surface, absorptivity to emissivity ratio, A to E ratio, they call it. So the sun is hitting your spacecraft, and depending how absorptive your material is, it's absorbing a certain number of watts. The sun is putting out a raw power at our distance, 93 million miles, the Earth is from the sun. It's putting out roughly 1,300 watts per square meter. And so if you made the mistake of making your satellite a pure black body, each square meter would be continuously getting 1,300 watts, and it would go up to some ridiculously high temperature. Make the surface of your spacecraft a perfect mirror for the whole frequency range coming out of the sun, and in theory your spacecraft can go down to 3 degrees Kelvin, the black body temperature of space. So by choosing the material that you paint your spacecraft with, so to speak, choose what temperature it will go to. So when there's no particles in space, you can't just stick out a thermometer. You can. You stick out a thermometer, and what color is the surface of your thermometer? Therefore, how much sunlight it's going to absorb is going to determine the temperature. Now, let me drop it. This problem we're now describing became a real serious problem for Story Musgrave, I think is the way he pronounces his name, as he gave us that lecture at the Astronomical Society of Long Island at the Cradle of Aviation Museum. He gave us this beautiful 1 or 2 hour lecture. This was about 2 years ago, about what it was like to do that very pivotal repair mission on Hubble. After Hubble was launched, we discovered the mirror was tuned to the wrong focal length, and he had to put a set of spectacles on Hubble. That set of spectacles was a piece of hardware as big as a piano, almost as heavy as a piano, and he had to replace that whole assembly. He was in orbit doing a spacewalk out of the space shuttle, between the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope that was locked down to the cargo hold for something close to 8.5 hours. Think about being in a diaper for 8.5 hours. Anyhow, each time the orbit of the Hubble goes around and spacecraft, the shuttle was going in orbit, roughly 90 minutes in orbit for a full turn, 45 minutes on the sun side of the Earth, and close to 45 minutes on the dark side of the Earth. So So each of those 45 minutes, he was in darkness. He had lots of lights on board of his spacesuit, and lots of lights shining on the work that he was doing. Let me drop it. But the gloves on his spacesuit have to be thin so that he has feeling. His fingers became so frozen during that mission. For the rest of his life, he has no feeling in all of his fingers because of what he did during that repair mission. So he ran into this temperature of space headlong. Apparently that wasn't properly planned. Well, no one had planned for that kind of a long duration space walk during this very elaborate, carefully choreographed repair procedure that he went through. The space suit itself has liquid water going through a Long John-like garment. So the life support system in that backpack of his spacesuit maintains the core of his body at the right temperature. But that circulating water did not go through the glove. Boy, did his hands literally freeze. Over to you, John, for any further comments that Roger might have on this one. KC2WGB, listening to Roger, K2IW and TechNet.
Okay, Roger, I'm listening on the input.
Dedicated as such, it's going to be preserved forever. And if you literally If you Google Penzias Wilson, Big Bang, Manatee, the black body, the first black body measurement of space, you Google any series of words, and Wikipedia will show you a picture of the dish that they made the measurement with. They expected the temperature of space to be near zero. They had a very sensitive receiver. They kept coming up with this excess noise. Couldn't figure out where the hell it was coming from. At first, they thought the pigeon droppings inside of the horn was doing it, and they cleaned out the pigeon droppings. They thought there was something wrong with their electronics, and they kept refining their electronics and measuring its precise temperature with an AIL hot-cold noise source, by coincidence. And the guy who invented the hot-cold noise source, a guy named Harvey Glass, is the guy who I eat lunch with every Monday. Let me drop. So they had traceability to the Bureau of Standards as to how sensitive their radio was. They knew with high accuracy what was the gain and efficiency of the dish. He finally figured out hey, that noise is there. It's real. It wasn't just some artifact. It wasn't some error in their instrumentation. And so all space is radiating that temperature because all that material is very slowly cooling off and expanding. And at the rate it's cooling off and expanding is one of the measurements that cosmic background explorer, Kobe, and then the Wilkinson anisotropy probe. Wait a minute, now, Wilkinson, the Wilkinson project, where's it now?
WMAP?
WMAP. Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, WMAP, then followed by, what was the name of the next one that made a more accurate measurement?
I don't know, maybe Paul's got that one.
Yeah, what's the third one in that series that's making the cosmic background radio experiment measurement, Paul? What's the third one? It's the WMAP and after Kobe. Over to you, Paul.
I think Mike was doing that, as well as Herschel. But Planck is now retired, so is Herschel.
Okay, so Planck, each one of these spacecraft made more and more accurate of the fine-grained structure. And we're talking about milli-kelvins and micro-kelvins of temperature difference of the various fine-grained structure of space. As you make finer and finer grain measurements, you get all kinds of hidden data. And some of the hidden data, they're now looking for black body leakage. In other words, I'm trying to think of the names of the two words for the, what's the name of those, the two energies here? We got the energy that's not emitting, but it's got a lot of gravity, and we've got the energy of expansion. Can't think of the names of the two things right now.
Matter and dark energy.
That's it, dark matter and dark energy. That's the words I couldn't think of. Well, we now have dark leakage. But depending on which scientist you listen to, it's so far controversial. And by the way, everything in the beginning was controversial. Black holes were controversial. Einstein's relativity, special relativity and general relativity were very controversial in the beginning. So all these things are controversial. Dark energy leakage. You have reason to believe that some of the material of this observable universe, by gravitational, chunks of material out there beyond the observable universe, might be attracting some of the material, causing dark leakage. And they think the Planck data is starting to show that. So there's a lot of hidden information in this cosmic microwave background. And as you sweep at various frequencies, you can go to the low microwave, medium microwave, and extremely high microwave frequencies, and you still keep coming up with that exact same number, 2.7315, I think it is, degrees Kelvin. That's how much heat is left over from the Big Bang. Ain't that crazy, Roger? K2JAS, K2IW in the TechNet.
close to that. What was Wilson's first name again?
Otto Penzias and something Wilson. Does anybody know Wilson's first name?
Very good. All right, Robert. Robert Wilson. There you go, Dick.
So these two guys at Bell Laboratories, for some reason, use this great big antenna that was at the home Bell Laboratory, right alongside of the 60-foot dish that Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, was using. And for a while, he was a good buddy of mine. And he was doing these beautiful 1296 experiments using that 60-foot dish. And one of my other buddies in Pennsylvania bought that dish when it became decommissioned, 60-foot dish. And his name or call letters right now, in western Pennsylvania. But they couldn't, even though they decommissioned the horn that made the black body radiation measurement, Wilson and Penzias measurement, that could not be sold because that became a national resource, national shrine. And so that antenna made a very pivotal measurement, which eventually resulted in the COBE, WMAP, Planck, and I don't know as much about Herschel, but I'm going to look that up. Paul, is Herschel trying to make even a more accurate measurement?
A quick question first, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
That hoghorn they used in Homedale, do you remember what that actually cost? It doesn't look expensive. Looks like pretty crude construction. What do you think?
I've stood alongside of that and held it in my hand, so to speak. I would say it was an inexpensive method of construction. I wouldn't call it crude, but it wasn't expensive. And in order for that horn to work well, the open mouth, the first thing you see when you look straight into the open mouth, that surface at the end of the horn has to be a perfect parabola, and it is. The sides of the horn, there's nothing magic about it. It just starts off at a very narrow point at one end where you launch the microwave signal. It slowly gets wider and wider and eventually hits that parabolic surface. The advantage of that so-called hog horn, H-O-G-G, the man who invented that horn, is that it has side lobes. An ordinary antenna can have side lobes 13, 15, 17 dB down. That thing has side lobes that are more than 35 or 40 dB down. Very well-controlled antenna pattern. When you aim that thing up at 30-degree angle looking at the sky, very little energy is coming from the back lobes of that antenna, disturbing your measurement. And even that amount of noise that comes into the back lobes of the antenna is relatively easy to calibrate because they are so predictable and so low. So that hoghorn antenna, the non-steerable versions, Bell Laboratories was using that for many of their microwave relay sites at 2.3 gigahertz in, say, the late 60s. Scattered across the United States. You had a whole bunch of towers with that hoghorn mounted on the side of the tower. Sharp point down, great big wide end up, and the mouth aimed at the horizon. And so these very wide, highly controlled antenna patterns, those things were set up roughly 30 miles apart across the United States. So an awful lot of your early television signals, let me drop it, your television and telephone signals across the United States were a whole lot of those hoghorns on towers at roughly 2.3 gigahertz transmitting all of that information. Howdy Doody was bragging about the fact that they're going to set up a coaxial cable across the United States. That was a big announcement in roughly 1948 that the television in the United States is going to become linked east coast to west coast by the coaxial cable. On paper, that sounds good. But you've got to put a couple of amplifiers every mile, and you're going to scan the whole darn United States with a coaxial cable. Boy, it's going to take a zillion amplifiers. Whereas with these microwave relay sites, every 30 or 40 miles apart with the right kind of terrain, that was a hell of a lot easier. Any further questions on that? Back to you, John. KC2WGB with Roger, K2LIW in the TechNet.
All right, let me check and see if Roger's got any further questions. Roger, if you copy, I'll be listening on the input.
The antenna was... Also,
Palmdale Laboratory, and he may have built, he may have designed that particular steerable Hardhorn antenna. Hogg invented the original shape of the antenna. Crawford, yes, probably designed that particular steerable version that could be steered in azimuth and elevation. It had a circular railroad track that would move it in azimuth, and it had a bunch of bearings that would move it in elevation. Very nicely designed, but not super expensive. I don't know the price of that, but if someone told me they built that for $100,000, I'd almost believe it. The raw materials that were in that, there was no gold in it, no silver plating or whatever. I'm pretty sure the horn itself is aluminum, and there's very little reason to make it out of non-aluminum. When I built the horn for listening to the Apollo astronauts on Apollo 15 and 16, in order to have the right diameter horns in order to make the dip-turn multi-mode feed horn. This is a feed horn that simultaneously launches the TE-11 circular and TM-11 circular mode out of this one horn. The advantage of launching those two modes with this crazy shaped horn is that it gives you an extremely clean antenna pattern with zero side lobes. But in order to have the right diameters of metal cans to build that horn, it has a wide area and a narrow area. Let me drop. I was able to make the wide area out of an American paint can. It was just the right size. But the narrow one, I had to use a foreign food can. Foods of All Nation had a Scottish oatmeal can that came out the right diameter. I didn't want to roll the steel myself. So by choosing the right diameters of cans and soldering them together, I got the whole thing to work right. The next thing I did is to make it look pretty, I painted it with silver paint. And I started worrying about what is the insertion loss of the paint that I'm putting inside of the horn. And I suddenly realized that if I wanted to make the horn glossy by using glossy paint, and the paint itself is probably a couple thousandths of an inch thick, no matter what I made the paint out of, when you've got a 4.5-inch wavelength and you're using a couple of thousandths of an inch of thick paint, the laws of physics won't allow you to get any loss out of that, no matter what the hell it is. Very similar to what happens when you build an 80-meter dipole and you decide to use 14-gauge wire. And you go through the conundrum, should I leave the plastic insulation on the wire or take it off? And if you leave the plastic insulation on it, yeah, the wire will tarnish a little more slowly. But radio-wise, it doesn't make any difference. The thickness of the insulation, when you're working with a wavelength of 265 meters, that's what 80 meters is, 265-foot wavelength approximately, and the thickness of the rubber on your 14-gauge wire of your 80-meter dipole is what? A 16th of an inch? That's nothing. As long as it's an insulating material, the RF energy goes down through that insulation until it hits the copper and it does its thing. And the same thing with the 2.3 gigahertz signal in that feed horn I made. It goes down through that paint until it hits the steel. I also worried about the conductivity of steel. You do a calculation of what the
repeater, time out.
You do a calculation of what's going on with the horn. You soon realize the power flux density, the number of watts per square meter hitting the surface of the horn, because of the area of the horn is so large, the watts per square meter that's hitting it is so low. You could probably build the horn out of carbon granules. You'd probably get 95% of the same performance. So horn antennas are very forgiving. I mean, the conductivity of your copper 14-gauge wire you build the 80-meter dipole out of, the conductivity of that wire does make a difference. You make that wire out of steel, and you'll get a slightly lower performance 80-meter dipole because there's not much material there. And all your kilowatt of energy you put into that dipole is going into the 16th of an inch diameter piece of copper. But you're putting your power into a horn where the large diameter of the horn is something like 12 inches in diameter, or 10 inches in diameter. The actual watts per square meter hitting that surface is so low that the conductivity doesn't matter. You can silver plate it if you want. You're probably going to make less than 1% change in the performance. Very similar to the very wide resonator that's in a RIW strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier for 432, which runs on a pair of 4CX250B tubes. They go through a great big effort. Let me drop. They go through a great great big effort of silver plating. That resonator, the resonator is something like 6 inches wide and something like 12 inches long, and it's double-sided copper clad. The current density, that resonator is so wide, the current density is so low, that you can run that transmitter kilowatt into it, key down for 10 minutes, turn it off, open it up real fast, and touch that resonator. It's ice cold. It's not dissipating any power. So that's the advantage of very wide surfaces. You can get away with murder with that. So ordinary aluminum is what I think the Hardhorn at Homedale is made out of. And they probably thought about silver plating it, but I don't think they did. If they did, I think they'd be wasting their time. And if they're going to silver plate it, the only place where it might matter a little bit is in the sharp end of the corn, at the horn. There the energy is kind of concentrated. But by the time you get to the big wide open end, I think it doesn't matter very much. Any further questions on all of the above? K2RIW and the TechNet.
No, I think that covers it. I imagine the railroad track and the ability to rotate the horn, besides turn it around in azimuth, is probably what cost more money than the horn itself. Back to you, Dick, and then on to Paul.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Paul, and that is the Greenbank, the great big telescope in Greenbank, West Virginia, and the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, and I was there during its construction. It consists of, it's 100 meter diameter antenna, roughly 310 feet in diameter, made out of something like 2,300 individual panels. In each one of those panels is a good fraction of a square meter. Every one of those panels has motors at least three corners so that each individual panel can be tuned to be in the exact right position as a function of wind load, snow loading, and the gravity and temperature and everything else to keep that dish accurate. As such, that 1,000-foot dish that normally would only go up to about 2.5 gigahertz is usable way beyond 100 gigahertz because it's so accurately tuned. While it's in operation, there's a laser rangefinder at the focal point looking at the corner cube at every one of those 2,300 panels and making sure they're all in the right position. In the case of the 18 panels for the James Webb Telescope, to your knowledge, is there any method by which those individual panels can be tuned? The reason I'm asking that question is because the Greenbank Telescope is operating at radio frequencies. And in order to put this in perspective, let me drop it. Us VHF, UHF amateurs have a gut feel for what 600 megahertz means. It's a little bit higher than the 70 centimeter band. It's not nosebleed high. We've got a feeling for what is 600 megahertz. Optical frequencies, where an optical telescope works, is 1 million times higher than 600 megahertz. As such, an optical mirror needs to be close to 1 million times higher than a radio mirror for a radio telescope. Well, the James Webb telescope is not quite optical. It's infrared, but it's getting into the optical region. So therefore, you want each one of those panels to be to the nearest couple of millionths of an inch. I wonder if they are tunable during operation. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yes. Okay, very good, Dick. And it's optical as well. It is into the optical range, primarily infrared. Every panel is tunable. First time I ever heard of that. First time I ever heard of that is the Keck telescope out in Hawaii. Every one of their 36 panels. Each one had an actuator on it, and you could adjust every one of them. And they're going to do the same thing with James Webb. And you asked, I just want to go back one, quite a few sentences ago, but you were wondering about the thrust on the Ariane 5. It's, like I said, it's below 4. It's around 3.2 million pounds of thrust. And the Atlas 5 is around 800,000, not quite a million. Idea. The Herschel and the Planck were both launched on the Ariane 5 rocket, which you were asking about. Herschel They both operated out in the L2, Lagrange Point 2, roughly a million miles away from the Earth, Sun, Earth, spacecraft location. And they stayed there and operated for quite a few years. Eventually ran low on coolant, which is the helium. And then they had enough fuel on board to move them out of there. They're now in Helios, spherical orbit, going around the sun. They get them away from that halo orbit to clear the area for future spacecraft, some of which are already there, like the Gaia, the European Space Agency. Back to you there.
Now, COBE, WMAP, and Planck were all measuring cosmic microwave background radiation. Is Herschel making the same kind of measurement, but even higher accuracy, both azimuth and elevation resolution, as well as temperature accuracy? Is Herschel a more accurate measurement than Planck? And is Herschel, European Space Agency, United States, joint effort? Tell me a few words on Herschel. I should know, but I don't. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Primarily, both were European Space Agency money. And they were, again, launched together, one on top of one another. And Herschel was like a mini James Webb. That was kind of like an infrared deal. But it had a finite amount of helium that it could use, you know, to keep it cool for the infrared. So, where James Webb should be able to go on for, you know, 10 or more years. Back to you.
So you're saying Herschel was a miniature James Webb? Wow. Probably infrared measurements. What's magic about James Webb that's going to make its cooling of its detector last for 10 years, where Herschel, I guess, only lasted for a year or two? What's magic about James Webb? Is it going to be a Stirling engine on board that does a good portion of the cooling so that not all of it is evaporating the very valuable helium? See, evaporating helium gets you down to numbers like 3 degrees Kelvin, 3 Kelvins, really cold. And there's even ways you can use the helium as a refrigerant to get even below that. And so making your detector as cold as possible makes it more and more sensitive. So what's magic about James Webb that's going to last? The cooling procedure is going to last for 10 years. Back to you, Paul, K2RIW. Not a good trick, whoever they did it.
Yeah, they do have a compressor type of system, you know, a refrigerant type of system. You know, it's located, the unit is actually located below the shade, so the operation of the unit will keep the heat away from the detectors, and it's piped directly on it. When the antenna stands up, this is all going to unfurl like an origami setup, but when it unfurls, the full tubing is going to extend, and you know, it's all attached to the compressor setup, but that's directly going to the head. It's supposed to keep the head. I'll have to look it up. I knew it a couple of months ago. I think it's 7 degrees absolute. That head is actually going to be colder. That's where the main detector is. And then the rest of the year, the dish itself, you notice there's no tube around it. You know, like Hubble has a tube. The tube is, because the Hubble is primarily light, and you want to keep any kind of light away from it. This you want to keep heat away from it, so that there's no tube. Anything that would be there would give off heat, and they want to keep this thing as cold as possible. But of course, then you need the 50-foot long size of a tennis court, 5-layer thick of mylar material as a shade to keep not only the sun's rays away, but reflection of the moon and a reflection of the earth. You don't want any heat going near this old detector. Dick, over to you.
Yeah, Hubble, I mean, James Webb is a really big piece of hardware. I'm going to guess the total price is quite a few billion dollars. That makes it pretty clear as to why they built only one We can't afford to build a backup on that one. And it's an extremely big piece of hardware with an awful lot of individual panels of the main mirror, darn big sub-reflector and a sub-sub-reflector, this huge five-layer or seven-layer heat shield on it, all being put at Lagrange Point number 2, a million miles away from Earth on the opposite side of the sun. My goodness, this is a high-risk mission. Very difficult, long-range, expensive, high-risk mission, and all the eggs in one basket. There is no backup. I sure hope it all works. Boy, there's going to be a lot of people crying for a long period of time if this one fails or falls. We've got a lot of emotion attached to this one. What do you think? WS2N, K2LAW.
Oh, and a lot of money, you know. Because look at us, we've been talking about this thing for years, and we'll be talking about it for more years to come. 2018, it gets launched. It's been in the works for 10, 15 years. I think 15 years ago, it was called the Next Generation Telescope. They didn't even have a name for it. They had plans on what they wanted to do, and it came out of all of that. They tried to drop the funding on it. They wanted to cancel the program. Came back again, and it's like a submarine. It kept coming back up, and the funding is $8 billion and over probably a 10-year build time frame. So, and then, you know, you said it's too expensive to build another one, but, you know, they have plans. There's something called the Atlas stand for something. Go what the acronym is, but it's been planned for years to replace the Hubble Space Telescope. There's no funding for it, but, you know, somebody might come up with something, and it might be another $8 billion project. I mean, it just goes on and on. They have long-term goals. After we're dead and gone, they'll be building these things. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of the Green Bank Telescope, 100 meters in diameter, each one of those 2,300 panels, it's got a corner reflector in the corner and a laser rangefinder at the focal point that scans all those panels and decides which ones need to be corrected. Each one has a set of motors, so if the orders are given to those little bitty motors on the back of each one of those panels to tune it. In the case of James Webb, which has 18 individual sections to that mirror, how do they determine what the error is? I haven't heard about a laser range finder between the focal point and each of those 18 panels that can tune them. I guess there are ways that you can look at a point source in space and by way of the image you get on infrared determine which one of the panels are out of tune. I think there's a way you can play that backwards, the so-called Fourier transform, but that's not easy. It sure would be nice if they can by some magic, measure the exact position of each one of the panels with reference to the focal point. The idea how they're doing that, Paul? It's a darn good trick. And I presume there's a bunch of motors, there's a couple of motors behind each panel that can tune it in position and let's call it azimuth and elevation aiming. WS2N, K2LAW.
I don't know yet. I saw these actuators. They look like, you know, very, very small things. They're not on there now. There's this backing, this beryllium frame. By the way, they chose beryllium because beryllium has, like, practically zero coefficient for expansion and contraction with the going from heating to cooling. And it's all, you know, they're going to have, you know, maybe 100 of these things that gets attached to it. They're all going to have to work. Don't know if they're mechanical. I don't know if they're... who knows? I haven't seen anything. Don't know. I would imagine they would have a laser beam mounted off the back of it, you know, not the front. They're going to need to take pictures. So I would imagine some sort of setup like that. But I don't know. We'll find that before 2018, I hope.
John, are you copying Roger? I think Roger's hangs up.
I'll switch over and see. QD going to the input. Roger.
Okay, thank you. I have a quick question for Dick, if he can do it.
in 5 minutes, no longer, I think, ended at that time. I want to know what happens when you increase the diameter of the radiating elements. If you go, let's say, a 14-gauge wire to a bird cage of a 12-inch diameter,
I heard enough of that. I heard enough of that question to understand what I think he's asking. If you look at what's called the caged, if you Google the word caged dipole, C-A-G-E-D, caged dipole, you'll see there are ways at VHF frequencies where you can literally make the apparent semiconductor of a dipole 4 or 5 inches in diameter, if you wanted to, by using a whole lot of individual wires displaced. I am doing that right now with the number of the patents I was involved in. At 900 megacycles, ordinarily a Yagi-like structure, three-element Yagi at 900 megacycles, each of your elements would be in the vicinity of an eighth inch or so wide. Eighth inch, maybe 3/32 of an inch wide. And I discovered by way of tinkering with a Rodenschwartz vector network analyzer with my typical method of tuning, long sticks with pieces of copper tape on the end held near the tips and near the center of each element. I soon discovered that as I made the elements wider and wider, the Q went down. That's good when it comes to an antenna. It's bad when it comes to a resonator acting as a filter. Let me drop. And if you look at that patent, which I could give you the patent number, for the resulting three-element Yagi, you'd say to yourself, how in the world could Mr. Hindusu Yagi, invented in 1928 and patented Yagi-like antenna, and along comes this guy K2LA in 2003 and re-patents a Yagi. Take a look at that. It's a very different-looking Yagi. The elements are 1/2 inch, 3/4 inch wide out of sheet metal. They got a bunch of holes in them that bent in an exotic manner. The tips curl around in funny ways. The driven element is very, there's probably about 15 claims to that patent as to what makes it different than a conventional Yagi. And when you do all that just right, an antenna that would normally be 2 megacycles wide at 915 megacycles, that Yagi antenna keeps all of its gain, keeps a VIS-WR of better than 1.1:1 across the whole 26 megacycles, 902 to 928, which is the band you have to operate on to do that service, that RFID reading. So that was, from some people's point of view, let me drop, that's a breakthrough antenna. You could call that the equivalent of a cage dipole. When you're making antennas out of sheet metals at a VHF frequency, whether you make the element itself completely round or very wide as a flat piece of sheet metal, the RF doesn't know the difference. You could make your 80-meter dipole out of literally sheets of metal. You wouldn't have to, there's nothing magic about round. It could be a sheet of metal, and it's only the width that really counts. Now, to make that equivalent, to build that antenna with that beautiful high gain performance and very broadband and extremely low gain performance, to build that out at 80 meters, you think now. I was operating at, let's see, that's roughly 1,000 megacycles. I knew this very well at one time. I think the wavelength is something like 4 inches. I think it's a 4-inch wavelength. And 4.5-inch in practice. I think the real wavelength before you do loading is more like 7 or 8 inches, and I'm making them 1/2 inch wide. So if I did that at 80 meters, I think you'd be making the dipole elements something like 30 feet in diameter. Very impractical. But if you did, you'd get a very broadband antenna. However, there are other crafty ways of making a broadband dipole. The Cobra antenna comes close, but there are even more elaborate ways. If you Google the word Bonnie Crystal, B-O-N-N-Y Crystal, that's the lady's name, engineer, who in the last couple of years invented very broadband dipole-like tuning procedures. You Google that word, Bonnie Crystal, and that you, not Google, you go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, and there's a way you can look up...
Repeater, time out.
There's a way you can look up patents by way of the inventor's name, and you look up the name Bonnie Crystal and dipole as a search combination. For all I know, there's a zillion inventors with the name of Crystal, but Bonnie Crystal plus dipole, and you'll see that she's got 10 different techniques of making extremely broadband impedance matching to a dipole-like structure. The most basic antenna on planet Earth, arguably, is a dipole, a Hertzian dipole. Here we are 150 years later, and what Mr. Hertz did, and still reinventing the dipole and dipole-like structures. You put them together just right, you got a Yagi. So, you haven't heard the end of the story yet. It's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Have you any further questions on all of the above? K2LAW and the TechNet. Oh, wait a minute now. We got 30 seconds left. You guys have just heard TechNet number 1575. We'll be back next week. Be kind to each other. John, go ahead, put the ribbons on it. You got it, John. K2LAW.
73 Dick, 73 John. Tune in at 11:30 for the Phillips. Maybe we'll be talking about life on Mars. Wishful thinking. John, 73.
73 Paul, 73 Dick. Enjoy. I'd like to thank everyone for joining the net and staying with us. Thank you for the questions. And all goes well. We'll be back next week and perform again. KC2, WGB clear.
And here we go. Dick, thank you very much for hosting the TechNet all these years. I'm listening. I'm enjoying it. Over to you.
Hey, Rich. Sometimes we talk about non-ham radio subjects. Ain't that crazy? At one time, people became a little bit unhappy that TechNet went into non-ham radio subjects. In my mind, there, Rich, inside of a good ham radio operator is a scientist trying to get out. The real ham radio operators are interested in quite a few different kinds of science. Over to you for any other comments. You got it, Rich. K2LAW.
It's true, Dick. No, I objected to it. I was one of the objectors at first. I no longer am. I rethought what I was thinking. I think it's all very great.
Yeah, you did a complete turnaround, Rich. Very well done. What you were objecting to at first was that we were discussing astronomy. And a year or two later, you on the TechNet asked us an astronomy question. You wanted us to give you suggestions as to the best kind of telescope to buy. So you went full circle. You came around very nicely, Rich, there.
Okay, Dick. Well, I have a telescope. You know, N2 Alpha Sierra, what's his name again? It's in my house. Gee, I can't think of it. And he gave me a telescope. I think it's Mead. I'm not sure. I gotta go in the other room and look. I haven't used it because, maneuvering in a wheelchair is gonna be difficult. But I do want it to, at least, I want to look at the moon.
Yeah, there's a lot of good things to listen to. N2ASS is Gregory. And very nice that he gave you a telescope. How about that? Over to you, Rich.
That's right. I'm ashamed of myself that I forgot his name. Greg. Yes, exactly. You know, when we ran out of oil in the house and we were waiting for a delivery, he came over with a jerry can and put some oil in my tank. He's a nice person. I think hams in general are very good people.
You got it. I think there are very few hams that are incarcerated in the United States because they've gotten into trouble. Bye-bye, you all. Be kind to each other. This is a hobby. But boy, is it educational. K2LAW clear.
Okay, Dick, not only is it educational, it's kind of like a brotherhood. We all get along. Sometimes we fight, but then we get back together. See you guys later. And John, you have a good night, too. You do a lot of stuff here, too. And Paul, you guys take care. and three out.
Okay, Rich. Have a good night. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. KC2, WGB clear.
73, Rich. I remember one time you asked about this SpaceX, the stock, you know, and I did look into that, by the way. Elon Musk, the owner of SpaceX, has no intention of bringing that place, that company public until he lands on Mars. There's your answer. It'll never be public until he puts the spacecraft on Mars. There's a question that you asked a long time ago, Rich. N2EO, WS2N, clear.
Well, I'm glad you answered it. Maybe, who knows, maybe they'll have a turnaround. Right now, I'm strapped. I'm broke. But if I get...
Newsline report number 1978 with a release date of Friday, September 25th, 2015. The following 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. In separate tragedies, two radio amateurs become silent keys. Area hams lend support to a Massachusetts cycling event to benefit ALS research. A new island gets activated in Connecticut's Housatonic River, and pigs fly, transmitting to receivers on the earth below. All this and more in Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1978 coming your way right now. Amateur radio repeater system.
AB2NQ N2ZEP.
Reddish yellow. I had dinner